This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Have crimes been committed inside the Bush White House? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Louis Scooter Libby, Chief of Staff to Vice President Cheney, has resigned. This after indictment for perjury, making false statements, and obstruction of justice. Karl Rove, top political aide to President Bush, is not indicted, but reportedly he is still under investigation. On To the Point, we'll go live to a news conference with the special prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald and get the details of today's indictments at the highest level of American government. What do they reveal about the reasons behind the war in Iraq, and what will they mean for a president who is already struggling in his second term? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Louis Scooter Libby, top aide to Vice President Cheney, has resigned. This after his indictment for perjury, making false statements, and obstruction of justice. Vice President Cheney says he has accepted the resignation with deep regret, points out that everyone under the American system who is accused is presumed innocent until proven guilty. In just a few moments, we'll be hearing from the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, who is scheduled to make a much-awaited statement about this case. In the meantime, Linda Feldman is with us. She is White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Linda, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, my pleasure.
All five counts of this indictment could mean 30 years in prison for Scooter Libby and $1 million in fines. These are all felonies, very serious charges.
Indeed. Yes, five counts, big stakes for him professionally. It's been suggested that this could just ruin him as a lawyer if he's not cleared of the charges or acquitted. But to me, the most intriguing aspect of this is that he was not found on, he wasn't charged on the kind of core allegation at issue was the illegal outing of a CIA agent. And, in the press release, Patrick Fitzgerald discussed, how Valerie Wilson's employment status was classified and that her affiliation with the CIA was not common knowledge outside the intelligence community, and that it's, her disclosure had the potential to damage national security in a range of serious ways, and yet no one so far has been found guilty of that core charge.
So once again, the special prosecutor says in a written statement, we haven't heard from him yet personally, that there was potential damage to national security. So let's go back to the charges then. Knowingly and corruptly endeavoring to influence, obstruct, and impeding the due administration of justice by misleading and deceiving the grand jury about how he learned that Valerie Plame, Valerie Wilson, the wife, of course, of Ambassador Joseph Wilson, was a CIA agent. So it's somewhat indirect in that respect.
That's right. He, the point is that he was discussing the identity of Joe Wilson's wife and the fact that she worked for the CIA with journalists. And he had claimed that he had learned of her identity from journalists when, in fact, his own notes had revealed that he had learned of Joe Wilson's wife from the vice president.
So, again, then, there is a difference in versions of the facts about the behavior of Libby and, to some extent, Vice President Cheney during the investigation, but not as far as the outing of the agent, as you pointed out, the original substantive question here.
That's right. And some legal analysts have surmised that Patrick Fitzgerald, as a talented prosecutor, is not going to pursue a case that he's not reasonably sure he can win on. So that what he's done by going on these other five counts is going with things that he feels he has a good chance with.
On the other hand, of course, when the special prosecutor says potential damage to national security, those are very strong words when you're talking about the top aide to the Vice President of the United States.
That's right. And, you know, as the vice president himself made clear in the statement that he just put out, these are just charges. Nobody has been found guilty. Everybody, you know, he didn't say this, but this is part of the line out of the White House, which is that everybody needs to step back and take a deep breath and just get a little perspective here. Scooter Libby faces very, very serious charges, but this is a legal process that we've now embarked on that's going to take a while, and, you know, Libby is innocent until proven guilty.
Once again, we're talking to Linda Feldman, who's White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And just as soon as Patrick Fitzgerald begins to make his statement, we will cut to that. Linda Feldman wants to hear it, as well as as us. What about Karl Rove?
Karl Rove is still under investigation. The good news for him today is that he wasn't indicted. The bad news is that he's not out of the woods. You know, he's dodged a bullet, but the bullet is still aiming at him. The thinking is that Patrick Fitzgerald will extend the term of the grand jury beyond its expiration, which was to be today. So legal analysts also say that once you have one indictment, that increases the chances that there will be other indictments. So I don't think Karl Rove is breathing a sigh of relief.
There is also some speculation, as I understand it, that rather than extending the term of this grand jury, mm-hmm. Fitzgerald may be able to use another grand jury that's already impaneled with the argument that this grand jury has already been sitting for a long, long time.
That's right. It's not clear. I don't know that it's been announced yet what will be the fate of this grand jury versus impaneling a new one to continue with the case, but Pat Fitzgerald isn't finished yet.
How important is Scooter Libby, first to the vice president, to secondly to the whole White House operation?
He's very important. He and Vice President Cheney are very, very close. Cheney thinks very highly of him. He views him as having a superior mind, talented analyst, very driven. He was a big supporter of the Iraq War. And Dick Cheney is widely seen as the most powerful vice president in history. So if you connect the dots, you've got the chief of staff of the most powerful vice president is now under indictment. This gets pretty close to the center of power.
Again, we're talking to Linda Feldman with the Christian Science Monitor. In just a moment, we're expecting to hear from Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back with more on accusations that crimes were committed at the highest levels of power inside the Bush White House on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, and once again talking about an extraordinary moment in American history with the most powerful aide to the most powerful vice president ever, having just been indicted on 5 counts of various charges, including perjury, making false statements, and obstruction of justice. We just heard from Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor that the special prosecutor did not charge Libby specifically with the outing of the CIA agent Valerie Plame / Will Wilson, the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. With us on the line, Laurie Levinson, professor of criminal law at Loyola Marymount School of Law in Los Angeles and a former special prosecutor herself. A federal prosecutor, beg your pardon. Professor, as we wait for Mr. Fitzgerald to come forward, what do you make of the fact that although there is an agent's protective act, which makes it illegal to reveal the identity of an agent in the way that Mr. Libby apparently is accused of doing, he wasn't charged for that.
No, he wasn't charged. And as you read through this lengthy indictment, you get the sense that he may not have been the first person to release this information. One of the most interesting things about this indictment is on paragraph 21, and it's very detailed, this reference to Official A, who had earlier in the week spoken to columnist Robert Novak about the CIA employee. And that was on July 10th. So it sounds like that, in fact, there's two questions that may have been in Fitzgerald's mind. One, whether it met the the intent requirements of the statute, that he knew that he was revealing confidential information to people who weren't entitled to it. And second, the real question is he the one who really initially revealed it?
Once again, we're talking with Laurie Levinson with the Loyola Marymount, a former prosecutor for the federal government. Here is the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald.
I'm the United States Attorney in Chicago. But appearing before you today is the Department of Justice Special Counsel in the CIA leak investigation. Joining me to my left is Jack Eckenrode, the special agent in charge of the FBI office in Chicago, who has led the team of investigators and prosecutors from day one in this investigation. A few hours ago, a federal grand jury sitting in the District of Columbia returned a 5-count indictment against I. Lewis Libby, also known as Scooter Libby, the vice president's chief of staff. The grand jury's indictment charges that Mr. Libby committed 5 crimes. The indictment charges 1 count of obstruction of justice of the federal grand jury, 2 counts of perjury, and 2 counts of false statements. Before I talk about those charges and what the indictment alleges, I'd like to put the investigation into a little context. Valerie Wilson was a CIA officer. In July 2003, the fact that Valerie Wilson was a CIA officer was classified. Not only was it classified, but it was not widely known outside the Intelligence Committee. Valerie Wilson's friends, neighbors, college classmates had no idea she had another life. The fact that she was a CIA officer was not well known for her protection, but for the benefit of all of us. It's important that if a CIA officer's identity be protected, that it be protected not just for the officer, but for the nation's security. Valerie Wilson's cover was blown in July 2003. The first sign of the cover being blown was when Mr. Novak published a column on July 14, 2003. But Mr. Novak was not the first reporter to be told that Wilson's wife, Valerie Wilson, Ambassador Wilson's wife, Valerie, worked at the CIA. Several other reporters were told. In fact, Mr. Libby was the first official known to have told a reporter when he talked to Judith Miller in June of 2003 about Valerie Wilson. Now, something needs to be borne in mind about a criminal investigation. I recognize that there's been very little information about this criminal investigation, but for a very good reason. It may be frustrating, but when investigations are conducted in secret, when investigations use grand juries, it's important that the information be closely held. So let me tell you a little bit about how an investigation works. Investigators do not set out to investigate a statute. They set out to gather the facts. It's critical that when an investigation is conducted by prosecutors, agents, and a grand jury, they learn who, what, when, where, and why. And then they decide, based upon accurate facts, whether a crime has been committed, who has committed the crime, whether you can prove the crime, and whether the crime should be charged. Agent Eckenrode doesn't send people out when $1 million is missing from a bank and tells them, just come back if you find wire fraud. The agent finds embezzlement. They follow through on that. That's the way this investigation was conducted. It was known that a CIA officer's identity was blown. It was known that there was a leak. We needed to figure out how that happened, who did it, why, whether a crime was committed, whether we could prove it, whether we should prove it. And given that national security was at stake, it was especially important that we find out accurate facts. There's another thing about a grand jury investigation. One of the obligations of the prosecutors and the grand juries is to keep the information obtained in the investigation secret, not to share it with the public. And as frustrating as that may be for the public, that is important, because the way our system of justice works, if information is gathered about people and they are not charged with a crime, we don't hold up that information for the public to look at. We either charge them with a crime or we don't. And that's why we've safeguarded information here to date. But as important as it is for the grand jury to follow the rules and follow the safeguards to make sure information doesn't get out, it's equally important that the witnesses who come before a grand jury, especially the witnesses who come before a grand jury who may be under investigation, tell the complete truth. It's especially important in the national security area. The laws involving disclosure of classified information in some places are very clear, and in some places they're not so clear. And grand jurors and prosecutors making decisions about who should be charged, whether anyone should be charged, what should be charged, need to make fine distinctions about what people knew, why they knew it, what they exactly said, why they said it, what they were trying to do, what appreciation they had for the information, and whether it was classified at the time. Those fine distinctions are important in determining what to do. That's why it's essential when a witness comes forward and gives their account of how they came across classified information and what they did with it, that it be accurate. Now that brings us to the fall of 2003, when it was clear that Valerie Wilson's cover had been blown, an investigation began. And in October 2003, the FBI interviewed Mr. Libby. Mr. Libby is the Vice President's Chief of Staff. He's also an assistant to the President and assistant to the Vice President for National Security Affairs. The focus of the interview was what was it that he had known about Wilson's wife, Valerie Wilson, what he knew about Ms. Wilson, what he said to people, why he said it, and how he learned it. And to be frank, Mr. Libby gave the FBI a compelling story. What he told the FBI is that essentially he was at the end of a long chain of phone calls. He spoke to a reporter, Tim Russert, and during the conversation, Mr. Russert told him that, hey, do you know that all the reporters know that Mr. Wilson's wife works at the CIA? And he told the FBI that he learned that information as if it were new, and it struck him. So he took this information from Mr. Russert, and later on he passed it on to other reporters, including reporter Matthew Cooper of Time magazine, reporter Judith Miller of the New York Times. And he told the FBI that when he passed the information on July 12th of 2003, 2 days before Mr. Novak's column, that he passed it on understanding that this was information he had gotten from a reporter, that he didn't even know if it was true. And he told the FBI that when he passed the information on to the reporters, he made clear that he did not know if this were true. This was something that all the reporters were saying, and in fact, he just didn't know, and he wanted to be clear of that. Later, Mr. Libby went before the grand jury. On two occasions in March of 2004, he took an oath and he testified, and he essentially said the same thing. He said that, in fact, he had learned from the vice president earlier in June 2003 information about Wilson's wife, but he had forgotten it. Now, he learned the information from Mr. Russert during this phone call. He learned it as if it were new. And when he passed the information on to reporters Cooper and Miller late in the week, he passed it on thinking it was just information he received from reporters, and that he told the reporters that, in fact, he didn't even know if it were true. He was just passing gossip from one reporter to another at the long end of a chain of phone calls. It would be a compelling story that would lead the FBI to go away if only it were true. It is not true, according to the indictment. In fact, Mr. Libby discussed the information about Valerie Wilson at least half a dozen times before this conversation with Mr. Russert ever took place, not to mention that when he spoke to Mr. Russert and he never discussed Valerie Wilson or Wilson's wife. He didn't learn it from Mr. Russert, and if he had, it would not have been new at the time. Let me talk you through what the indictment alleges. The indictment alleges that Mr. Libby learned the information about Valerie Wilson at least three times in June of 2003 from government officials. And let me make clear there was nothing wrong with government officials discussing Valerie Wilson or Mr. Wilson or his wife in imparting the information to Mr. Libby. But in early June, Mr. Libby learned about Valerie Wilson and the role she was believed to play in having sent Mr. Wilson on a trip overseas from a senior CIA officer on or around June 11th, from an undersecretary of state on or around June 11th, and from the vice president on or about June 12th. It's also clear, as set forth in the indictment, that sometime prior to July 8th, he also learned it from somebody else working in the vice president's office. So at least four people within the government told Mr. Libby about Valerie Wilson, often referred to as Wilson's wife, working at the CIA and believed to be responsible for helping organize a trip that Mr. Wilson took overseas. In addition to hearing it from government officials, it's also alleged in the indictment that at least three times Mr. Libby discussed this information with other government officials. It's alleged in the indictment that on June 14th of 2003, a full month before Mr. Novak's column, Mr. Libby discussed it in a conversation with the CIA briefer, in which he was complaining to the CIA briefer his belief that the CIA was leaking information about something or making critical comments, and he brought up Joe Wilson and Valerie Wilson. It's also alleged in the indictment that Mr. Libby discussed it with the White House press secretary on July 7, 2003, over lunch. And what's important about that is that Mr. Libby, the indictment alleges, was telling Mr. Fleischer something on Monday that he claims to have learned on Thursday. In addition to discussing it with Mr. The press secretary on July 7th, There was also a discussion on or about July 8th, in which counsel for the vice president was asked a question by Mr. Libby as to what paperwork the Central Intelligence Agency would have if an employee had a spouse go on a trip. So there were at least seven discussions involving government officials prior to the day when Mr. Libby claims he learned this information as if it were new from Mr. Russert. And in fact, when he spoke to Mr. Russert, they never discussed it. But in addition to focusing on how it is that Mr. Libby learned this information and what he thought about it, it's important to focus on what it is that Mr. Libby said to the reporters. And the account he gave to the FBI and to the grand jury was that he told reporters Cooper and Miller at the end of the week on July 12th, and that what he told them was he gave them information that he got from other reporters, that other reporters were saying this, that Mr. Libby did not know if it were true, and in fact, Mr. Libby testified that he told the reporters he did not even know if Mr. Wilson had a wife. And in fact, we now know that Mr. Libby discussed this information about Valerie Wilson at least four times prior to July 14, 2003, on three occasions with Judith Miller of the New York Times and on one occasion with Matthew Cooper of Time magazine. The first occasion on which Mr. Libby discussed it with Judith Miller was back in June 23rd of 2003. Just days after an article appeared online in the New Republic, which quoted some critical commentary from Mr. Wilson. After that discussion with Judith Miller on June 23, 2003, Mr. Libby also discussed Valerie Wilson on July 8th of 2003. And during that discussion, Mr. Libby talked about Mr. Wilson in a conversation that was on background as a senior administration official. And when Mr. Libby talked about Wilson, he changed the attribution to a former Hill staffer. During that discussion, which was to be attributed to a former Hill staffer, Mr. Libby also discussed Wilson's wife, Valerie Wilson, working at the CIA. And then finally, again, on July 12th. In short, and in those conversations, Mr. Libby never said, this is something that other reporters are saying. Mr. Libby never said, this is something that I don't know if it's true. Mr. Libby never said, I don't even know if she had a wife. At the end of the day, what appears is that Mr. Libby's story, that he was at the tail end of a chain of phone calls, passing on from one reporter what he heard from another, was not true. It was false. He was at the beginning of the chain of the phone calls, the first official to disclose this information outside the government to a reporter, and that he lied about it afterwards, under oath and repeatedly. Now, as I said before, this grand jury investigation has been conducted in secret. I believe it should have been conducted in secret, not only because it's required by those rules, but because the rules are wise. Those rules protect all of us. We are now going from a grand jury investigation to an indictment, a public charge, and a public trial. The rules will be different. But I think what we see here today, when a vice president's chief of staff is charged with perjury and obstruction of justice, it does show the world this is a country that takes its law seriously, that all citizens are bound by the law. But what we need to also show the world is that we can also apply the same safeguards to all our citizens, including high officials. Much as they must be bound by the law, we must follow the same rules. So I ask everyone involved in this process, anyone who participates in this trial, anyone who covers this trial, anyone sitting home watching these proceedings, to follow this process with an American appreciation for our values and our dignity. Let's let the process take place. Let's take a deep breath and let justice process the system. I would be remiss at this point if I didn't thank the team of investigators and prosecutors who worked on it, led by Agent Eckenrode, but particularly the staff under John Dyam from the counter-espionage section in the Department of Justice, Mr. Zeidenberg from Public Integrity, and as well as the agents from the Washington Field Office and my close friends at the Chicago U.S. Attorney's Office, all of whom contributed to a joint effort. And with that, I'll take questions.
Yes, sir. Mr. Fitzgerald, this began as a leak investigation, but no one is charged with any leaking. Is your investigation finished? Is this another leak investigation that doesn't lead to a charge of leaking?
Let me answer the two questions you asked in one. Okay, is the investigation finished? It's not over, but I'll tell you this. Very rarely do you bring a charge in a case that's going to be tried, and would you ever end a grand jury investigation? I can tell you the substantial bulk of the work in this investigation is concluded. This grand jury's term has expired by statute. It could not be extended, but it's an ordinary course to keep a grand jury open to consider other matters, and that's what we will be doing. Let me then ask your next question. Well, why is this leak investigation that doesn't result in a charge? I've been trying to think about how to explain this, so let me try. I know baseball analogies are the fad these days. Let me try something. If you saw a baseball game and you saw a pitcher wind up and throw a fastball and hit a batter right smack in the head and really, really hurt them, you'd want to know why the pitcher did that. You'd wonder whether or not the person just reared back and decided, I've got bad blood with this batter. He hit two home runs off me. I'm just going to hit him in the head as hard as I can. You also might wonder whether or not the pitcher just let go of the ball or his foot slipped and he had no idea to throw the ball anywhere near the batter's head. And there's lots of shades of gray in between. You might learn that you wanted to hit the batter in the back. It hit him in the head because he moved. You might want to throw it under his chin, but end up hitting him in the head. And what you'd want to do is have as much information as you could. You want to know what happened in the dugout. Was this guy complaining about the person he threw at? Did he talk to anyone else? What was he thinking? How does he react? All those things you'd want to know. And then you'd make a decision as to whether this person should be banned from baseball, whether he should be suspended, whether he should do nothing at all and just say, hey, the person threw a bad pitch, get over it. In this case, it's a lot more serious than baseball. And the damage wasn't to one person. It wasn't to Valerie Wilson. It was done to all of us. And as you sit back, you want to learn, why was this information going out? Why were people taking this information about Valerie Wilson and giving it to reporters? Why did Mr. Libby say what he did? Why did he tell Judith Miller three times? Why did he tell the press secretary on Monday? Why did he tell Mr. Cooper? And was this something where he intended to cause whatever damage was caused? Or did he intend to do something else? And where are the shades of gray? And what we have when someone charges obstruction of justice is the umpire gets sand thrown in his eyes. He's trying to figure out what happened, and somebody blocked their view. As you sit here now, if you're asking me what his motives were, I can't tell you. We haven't charged it. So what you were saying is the harm in an obstruction investigation is it prevents us from making the very fine judgments we want to make. But I also want to take away from the notion that somehow we should take an obstruction charge less seriously than a leak charge. This is a very serious matter, and compromising national security information is a very serious matter. But the need to get to the bottom of what happened and whether national security was compromised by inadvertence, by recklessness, by maliciousness is extremely important. And we need to know the truth. And anyone who would go into a grand jury and lie, obstruct, and impede the investigation has committed a serious crime. I will say this. Mr. Libby is presumed innocent. He would not be guilty unless and until a jury of 12 people came back and returned a verdict saying so. But if what we allege in the indictment is true, then what is charged is a very, very serious crime that will vindicate the public interest in finding out what happened here. Yes, sir.
Mr. Fitzgerald, do you have any evidence that the Vice President of the United States, one of Mr. Libby's original sources for this information, encouraged him to leak it or encouraged him to lie about leaking it?
I'm not making allegations about anyone, nor charging the indictment. Now, let me back up, because I know what that sounds like to people if they're sitting at home. We don't talk about people that are not charged with a crime in the indictment. I would say that about anyone in this room who has nothing to do with the offenses. We make no allegation that the Vice President committed any criminal act. We make no allegation that any of the other people who provided or discussed with Mr. Libby committed any criminal act. But as to any person you ask me a question about other than Mr. Libby, I'm not going to comment on anything. That's not to please don't take that as any indication that someone has done something wrong. That's a standard practice. If you followed me in Chicago, I say that 1,000 times a year. And we just don't comment on people because we could start telling you, well, this person did nothing wrong, this person did nothing wrong. And then if we stop commenting, then you'll start jumping to conclusions. So please take no more. Mr. Isikoff.
For all the sand thrown in your eyes, it sounds like you do know the identity of the leaker. There's a reference to a senior official at the White House, Official A, who had a discussion with Robert Novak about Joe Wilson's wife. Can you explain why that official was not charged in this indictment?
And I'll explain this. I know that people want to know whatever it is that we know, and they're probably sitting at home at TV thinking, I want to jump through the TV, grab him by his collar, and tell him to tell us everything they figured out over the last 2 years. We just can't do that. It's not because we enjoy holding back information from you. That's the law. And one of the things we do with a grand jury is we gather information, and the explicit requirement is if we're not going to charge someone with a crime, if we decide that a person did not commit a crime, we cannot prove a crime, doesn't merit prosecution, we do not stand up and say we gathered all this information on the commitment that we're going to follow the rules of grand jury secrecy, which say we don't talk about people not charged with a crime, and then at the end say, well, It's a little inconvenient not to give answers out, so I'll give it out anyway. I can't give you answers on what we know and don't know other than what's charged in the indictment. It's not because I enjoy being in that position. It's because the law is that way. I actually think the law should be that way. We can't talk about information not contained in the four corners of the indictment.
Yes, sir. Is Karl Rove off the hook, and are there any other individuals who might be charged? You say you're not quite finished.
And all I can say is the same answer I gave before. If you ask me any name, I'm not going to comment on anyone named because we either charge someone or we don't talk about them, and don't read that answer in the context of the name you gave me. Carol.
What can you say about what you're still working on?
I can't. I mean, I don't mean that flippantly, but the grand jury doesn't give an announcement about what they're doing, what they're looking at, unless they charge an indictment. I can tell you that no one wants this thing to be over as quickly as I do, as quickly as Mr. Eckenrode does. I'd like to wake up in my bed in Chicago. He'd like to wake up in his bed in Philadelphia. And we recognize that we want to get this thing done. I will not end the investigation until I can look anyone in the eye and tell them that we have carried out our responsibility sufficiently to be sure that we've done what we could to make intelligent decisions about when to end the investigation. We hope to do that as soon as possible. I just hope that people will take a deep breath and just allow us to continue to do what we have to do. Yes,
sir. Mr. Fitzgerald, you said that there was damage done to all of us, damage to the entire nation. Can you be any more specific about what kind of damage you're talking about?
The short answer is no, but I can just say this. I'm not going to comment on things beyond what's said in the indictment. I can say that for the people who work at the CIA and work at other places, they have to expect that when they do their jobs, that classified information will be protected. They have to expect that when they do their jobs, that information about whether or not they're affiliated with the CIA will be protected. And they run a risk when they work for the CIA that something bad could happen to them. But they have to make sure that they don't run the risk that something bad is going to happen to them for something done by their own fellow government employees. But getting into the specifics of the damage, I won't. But I do owe Carol the next question.
You mentioned the importance to you of grand jury secrecy, and you have been leak-free. But I want to know what your thoughts are about a series of leaks about your investigation. What was your interpretation of what some people have described as manipulative, selective leaking about your investigation by people close to your witnesses?
And all I can say is, I'll just say this. I'm not going to comment on why certain things were leaked or any speculation I might have where it was leaked from. I think the average person does not understand that the rule of grand jury secrecy binds the prosecutors in the grand jury. It binds the agents who come across the grand jury information. It binds the grand jurors. Any one of us could go to jail if we leak that information. It does not bind witnesses. Witnesses can decide to tell their testimony or not. So if this were a bank robbery and we put a witness in the grand jury about the bank robbery, I would go to jail, he would go to jail, and the grand jurors would go to jail if they walked out and told you about it. But the person who went into the grand jury could walk out and hold a press conference at the front steps. So they're not breaking the law by discussing the grand jury information. I would prefer for the integrity of the investigation to not be discussed, but I just think people may not understand that certain people are not restricted in talking about grand jury information, and certain are. All I can do is make sure that myself and everyone on our team follows those rules. Yes, sir.
Mr. Fitzgerald, you said that it was okay for government officials to be discussing among themselves Mrs. Wilson's identity. Were you troubled, though, that at least a half dozen people outside the CIA seemed to be talking about this in the weeks before her name was disclosed?
My job is to investigate whether or not a crime is committed, can be proved, and should be charged. I'm not going to comment on what to make beyond that. And there's, it's not my jurisdiction, not my job, not my judgment. Yes, ma'am.
I know you just talked about having sand in your eyes and we have the obstruction charge here. Can you give us any sense of how you think you might, how long it might take you now to determine if there was this underlying crime that occurred dealing with the unauthorized disclosure?
I can't and I wouldn't. And if I had predicted, 2 years ago when it started, when we'd be done, I would have been done a year ago. So all I can tell you is as soon as we can get it done, we will. Yes, sir.
Okay, you identified Mr. Fleischer as one of the people that Mr. Libby spoke with. Could you say who the counsel to the VP was and also the Undersecretary of State that he spoke with?
We've referred to people by their titles in the indictment just because that's a practice. We don't allege they did anything wrong, but we said White House Press Secretary, and we talked about counsel for the Vice President, and I generally don't identify people beyond the indictment, and I'll talk to Randy Sanborn, who tells me what I'm allowed to do at the break. If we can provide you those names, we will. I'm not so sure we can, so we better not do it in front of a microphone. Let me just go over here.
In the end, was it worth keeping Judy Mill in jail for 85 days in this case? And can you say how important her testimony was in producing this indictment?
Let me just say this. No one wanted to have a dispute with the New York Times or anyone else. We can't talk generally about witnesses. There's much said on the public record. I would have wished nothing better that when the subpoenas were issued in August 2004, witnesses testified then, and we would have been here in October 2004 instead of October 2005. No one would have went to jail. I didn't have a vested interest in litigating it. I was not looking for a First Amendment showdown. I also had to say my job was to find out what happened here, make reasoned judgments about what testimony was necessary, and then pursue it. And we couldn't walk away from that. I could have not have told you a year ago that we think that there may be evidence that a crime is being committed here, obstruction, that there may be a crime behind it. I'm just going to walk away from it. And our job was to find the information responsibly. We then, when we issued the subpoenas, we thought long and hard before we did that. And I can tell you, there's a lot of reporters whose reporting and contacts have touched upon this case that we never even talked to. We didn't bluff people. And what we decided to do was to make sure before we subpoenaed any reporter that we really needed that testimony. In addition to that, we scrubbed it thoroughly within ourselves, but we also, when we went to court, we could have taken the position that it's our decision whether to issue a subpoena, but we made sure that we put a detailed, classified, sealed filing before the district court judge, the chief judge, Hogan in the District of Columbia. So we wanted to make sure that if he thought our efforts were off base, if what we were saying, representing to him was the case, was off, that he would have those facts when he made the decision. Judge Hogan agreed and felt that we met whatever standard there might be for issuing a subpoena. That then went up to the District of Columbia Court of Appeals with that same filing, and they found the same results, and it went to the Supreme Court. So I think what we did in seeking that testimony was borne out by how the judges ruled. At the end of the day, I don't know how you could ever resolve this case. To walk into you a year ago and say, you know what, forget the reporters, we have someone telling us that they told Mr. Cooper and Ms. Miller that they didn't know if this information were true. They just heard it from other reporters. They didn't know if he had a wife, and charge a person with perjury, only to find out that's what happened. That would be reckless. On the other hand, if we walked away and said, well, there are indications that, in fact, this is not how the conversation would happen. There are indications that there might be perjury or obstruction of justice here. I'm going to fold up my tent and go home. That would not fulfill our mandate. I tell you, I will say this, I do not think that reporters should be subpoenaed anything close to routinely. It should be an extraordinary case. But if you're dealing with a crime, and what's different here is the transaction is between a person and a reporter. They're the eyewitness to the crime. If you walk away from that and don't talk to the eyewitness, you are doing a reckless job of either charging someone with a crime that may not turn out to have been committed. And that frightens me, because there are things that you can learn from a reporter that would show you the crime wasn't committed. What if, in fact, you know, the allegations turned out to be true, that he said, hey, I sourced it to other reporters, I don't know if it's true. So I think the only way you can do an investigation like this is to hear from all the witnesses. I wish Ms. Miller spent not a second in jail. I wish we didn't have to spend time arguing very, very important issues and just got down to the brass tacks and made the call of where we were. But I think it had to be done.
This is Warren Olney back with To the Point. We've been listening to Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor in the case against the, which has turned out to be a case against Scooter Libby, who is the man indicted today on five felony counts for perjury, obstruction of justice, and misleading the grand jury in the investigation of who outed Valerie Plame, the CIA agent. Listening with us, Laurie Levinson, professor of criminal law at Loyola Marymount School of Law in Los Angeles, former federal prosecutor. Professor Levinson, have you ever heard a news conference like that?
Not really. I have to say that this is extraordinary, not just because Mr. Fitzgerald is so articulate, not just because he sounds so dedicated, but in fact, he is being so detailed as much as he can about the nature of this investigation, why they brought certain types of charges, and the fact that there are things that he cannot tell people. But most importantly, he's letting everyone know why this is important. You know, we heard last week on some of the talk shows, oh, it's just perjury. Oh, it's just obstruction. That's because they don't have a real crime. After listening to Mr. Fitzgerald, you begin to realize this is the real crime, trying to, as he said, throw sands in the eyes of people who are trying to find out what's happening in government, why is the information about a CIA operative being leaked?
On the other hand, he did not say, refused to say, exactly what was the damage to the nation by the outing of Valerie Plame, although he said people in her kind of position have to be able to do their jobs without thinking that people in the government are going to reveal their identities.
That's right. I mean, no one's suggesting that Valerie Plame's life was in any greater danger, thankfully, because of this. But what he's suggesting is that this is about government integrity on so many levels. The fact that when we have confidential things, they should stay confidential. And then when someone is interviewed by law enforcement to find out about a leak, they should be honest about it. So the whole theme here is government integrity.
We're talking with Laurie Levinson in Los Angeles, professor of criminal law, former federal prosecutor. We're going to take a very brief break. We will come back in a moment and continue this conversation on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Just to bring you up to date, we devoted most of our program today to the live news conference of Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor in the case involving the outing of CIA agent Valerie Plame. He has indicted, or the grand jury, I should say, has indicted Louis Scooter Libby, the top aide to Vice President Cheney, for perjury, making false statements, and obstruction of justice. Mr. Libby has resigned. The vice president says that let us not forget that all people accused under our system are innocent until proven guilty, and says that he has lost a valuable aide, or rather that Mr. Libby has been a valuable aide and a great public servant. Once again, we just heard a long and rather extraordinary explanation by the special prosecutor of what he has done and why he has done it. Katie Harriger is a political science professor at Wake Forest University and an expert on special prosecutors. Professor, let me ask you the same question I asked a moment ago of our former federal prosecutor, Laurie Levinson, and that is, have you ever heard a news conference like this?
Well, no. I thought, as she said, that there was something unique about it in terms of his both attempt to justify what he had done, but also his acknowledgement of what he felt he couldn't talk about. I think in special prosecutors in the past that have been were under the independent counsel statute, you know, tended to have to give a quite detailed report that was required by law that allowed that where they often revealed much more than Fitzgerald is prepared to reveal.
On the other hand, of course, he has a trial coming up.
That's right. And, of course, you know, one thing that happens with trials, that's really where the prosecutor goes public. Certainly, I think we'll learn more as the trial develops.
Are you surprised at the amount of evidence he did reveal about the number of meetings that had been held and what was said at each of those meetings, obviously referring to people who'd taken part in the meetings and by inference to their testimony, which seems to have been in conflict with Scooter Libby's?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think really he had to in order to make the case that he wants to make, or at least to justify the indictments that are there. I mean, if what you're going to charge is obstruction and perjury and false statements, then I think you have to show what your evidence is that they're false.
You're not a lawyer. You're a political
science
professor. How do you think this is going to be received from a political standpoint?
Well, I think it's interesting, and there's so much happening right now for the Bush administration that you can sort of see this as one more piece of bad news. On the other hand, you know, if it were the only game in town, it might be getting more attention than it'll get because when it's competing with the war and the Myers withdrawal and the new appointment of a Supreme, you know, a new nomination and all of those sorts of things. So it's, you know, it may be a double-edged sword in the sense that on the one hand, it's competing with a lot of other things for attention, but it adds to the sense that things are not going well for the Bush administration.
Katie Harriger, a political science professor at Wake Forest University. David Nather is a senior writer for Congressional Quarterly. And David, I understand you're working on a story about what's next for the Bush administration. What can you tell us so far?
Well, yeah, the big question right now is how does the president recover from a scandal like this, particularly in a second term when, you know, other troubles have been piling up anyway. What we did is we looked at a couple of examples, President Reagan's second term and President Clinton's second term. President Reagan's second term scandal, the Iran-Contra scandal, is probably a more comparable example, or it may be more applicable to the kind of model that President Bush may want to look at, because Reagan did rebound from Iran-Contra. There were times when people thought that was not possible. His own commission portrayed him as an out-of-touch, hands-off kind of manager who's let his aides run amok, and people weren't sure he'd come back from that. What he did is he fired his chief of staff, who was taking the blame for a lot of the problems, brought in Howard Baker, who was a former Senate Majority Leader, a widely respected figure in Washington. He brought in some other sort of old Washington hands and restored, you know, a symbolic gesture that restored confidence in the White House. And then he turned to outward to foreign policy, to arms control, and ended up signing some historically significant arms reductions treaties with Mikhail Gorbachev. By the end, most people, most historians had considered him to have been completely recovered.
On the other hand, this is a trial, which presumably will drag out for some time, and the special prosecutor didn't completely foreclose the possibility of charging somebody else, so it could come back to bite again and again.
Well, yeah, exactly. There's this sense that there's another even bigger shoe that hasn't dropped yet, because even though Fitzgerald wouldn't talk about Rove at the press conference, there's this this wide presumption that the ongoing investigation is still looking at him. I was talking to one of the House Republicans up on the Hill today to see what he thought was the significance of Libby's indictment. He said, well, it's less significant than it would have been if it were Rove, just because Rove is at the center of so much of this White House operation. He's so much better known. Libby hasn't been as well known to the public until now. But yeah, you're right. You know, nobody wants to have a long drawn out trial grabbing headlines in the press. More broadly, of course, the indictment of Tom DeLay is going to lead to a trial eventually. That's going to produce even more headlines that certainly the Republican Party doesn't want to see. And aside from the question of whether President Bush can recover, of course, is what's going to happen to the Republicans in the 2006 elections. This is about the last kind of political environment that they want to be running in.
David Nather, once again, senior writer for Congressional Quarterly. Back to Laurie Levinson at Loyola Marymount School of Law, former federal prosecutor. Reporters today asked about Official A, I believe that was the phrase that was used. You've read the indictment. What was the role of Official A, and is there any way of determining who it might have been? Based on our conversation, it might have been Vice President Cheney. It might have been Karl Rove. It might have been somebody we've never heard of before.
Well, here's where I think that Fitzgerald was playing a little cagey. I mean, because he did mention the name of one official, and then he said in the rest of the conference, oh, I can't remember I can't say names because they're not charged. Well, Warren, you know, people are named all the time as unindicted co-conspirators. So I think there's another reason they're not mentioning names. You're absolutely right. Official A could be more likely Karl Rove than I would think Vice President Cheney, but we have no way of knowing. All we do know is that elsewhere in the indictment, they refer to people by their position, and you would think that if that Official A was at the level of the vice president, we might have seen something more specific. But we don't know. Somehow, the person who spoke to Novak, they're trying to cover his identity.
Okay, and once again, Robert Novak, of course, the columnist who first revealed publicly the name of Valerie Plame, he hasn't been discussed at all by the special prosecutor. We'll have to see what role he might have played. Maybe that'll come up in the trial. Maybe it'll come up in further investigation. Laurie Levinson, when the special prosecutor says, as he did, look, the grand jury has gone out of existence, and yet the investigation continues to be open, how does he do that?
No problem at all. There's always another grand jury. It simply means that that group of citizens, 23 citizens, is unavailable. But he can start up on Monday with another grand jury. He doesn't have to repeat the whole investigation. He can just pick up where he left off. And that's what I would expect to happen. If they're still focusing on other players, and it sounds like they are, as opposed to trying to bring more charges against Libby, they just need to go to that grand jury and keep on investigating.
Back to Katie Harriger, our political science professor at Wake Forest. The Democrats are saying that what all this has to do with is the argument about going to war in Iraq. That, of course, was not even raised by the special prosecutor in his lengthy news conference today. Do you think, from a political standpoint, given what we have heard, and it's been fairly extensive as these matters go, the Democrats are going to be able to make that case?
Well, in some ways, it's an easier way to explain the story to the public, I think, than the sort of complex set of circumstances about who spoke with whom, when, and those sorts of things. That, you know, I think the public tends to look at kind of the big picture. What's this about? And so when they looked at the the pursuit of Clinton, for example, you know, they said this is about sex and not about lying. So I think the question is, will the public see this? Is this about the war, or is it really about something, you know, much more minor? Clearly, because it was involving decisions that were being made leading up to the war, it points to the war in some way that I think could be very problematic for the president.
Laura Levinson, back to you. Based on your experience as a prosecutor, the sentences involved, potential sentences for five felony counts of the kind we've heard described today, could have a total penalty of 30 years in prison and $1 million fine. I suppose it's utterly speculative to suggest at this point that we might be able to determine what an official of this rank might get in the way of a sentence if, for example, he were convicted of all five. Is that just not worth asking at this point?
Well, no, you can ask. I want, you know, it's not likely that he would get 30 years. Could he get about 5 years? That's quite possible, because each of the false statements and perjury counts is a five-year count. It's the obstruction that's 10 years. I mean, we have to wait to see how serious this obstruction was. In other words, you know, why were they covering up? What were they worried about, the conduct that was going on in the White House, before a judge could decide what should be the punishment on that big charge?
Well, thank you for being with us again. Laura Levinson, professor of criminal law at Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles and a former federal prosecutor. Thanks also to Katie Harriger, a political science professor at Wake Forest University, also expert on special prosecutors. And thanks also to David Nather, who's with us, a senior writer for Congressional Quarterly, and our earlier guest in the beginning of our program before we went to the live news conference by the special prosecutor, Linda Feldman, White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Once again, the top aide to the most powerful vice president in American history has been indicted on five counts, felony counts. We've heard about them in detail. We'll see what happens next. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper, Jonah King, Ileana Justice, Karen Radziter, and Kristen Bordahl. Technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.